This is Business Impact, a podcast series from UCD College of Business, Ireland's leading business school. I'm your host, Emmett Oliver, and each episode I'll be joined by world-renowned faculty from across the College of Business, as well as international industry leaders who'll offer us insight, spark curiosity, and challenge you to rethink how you do business in a changing world. Welcome to the latest episode of Business Impact. It's great to have you along. We're very busy heading into the final quarter of the year, and boy, is it busy out there in the external world beyond this podcast. There's so much things we could light upon and just feature and dissect, but we have to be very selective. A bit strange the last episode, because of course I was in the other chair answering questions from Dr. Maeve Houlihan, of course, who is the director of the Quinn Business School. A little bit peculiar and uncomfortable at times, but thanks very much to Maeve for walking us through that podcast. Hopefully she did a good job, but not that well a job, so that I'm out of a job on this podcast. So it was very enjoyable to talk to her. We both have Clare connections, so we were delighted to get through some of that material and looking back at the formation of the Irish state back in the 20s and 30s and how that influences the shape of the Irish economy in 2025. Now, mostly on this podcast, you hear a guest, they come on and we don't talk to them again. Why? Because we like to keep the throughput going. We like to see each individual guest making an individual contribution. But today we are breaking our rules because the next conversation is that topical and that much a modish kind of conversation, right in the news, right on the top of anyone's priority list. And it is about the whole world of carbon emissions and sustainability and aviation. And one of the reasons we're having this conversation, well, there's two actually. One is because kind of noticed some comments from Bill Gates about a week ago at the time of recording this podcast, where he talks about not hitting certain targets and what kind of investments in carbon emissions are needed in the future and which ones will be the best, and possibly reprioritizing in that area, which kind of shocked a lot of people. It's coming from him, so associated with the climate change debate. So that's one reason for having the next conversation. But secondly, one of our own staff happens to be on hand, and that is Professor Tom Conlon, who is a professor of finance here at the Business School in UCD. And he's written, along with his co-authors, a fascinating new paper in the Science Journal, which is a very, very prestigious journal in this whole area, talking about somewhat similar to Bill Gates, but coming out of there from a slightly different perspective. So when we have somebody on staff who's right in the heart of the debate and in the heart of the conversation, we like to tap into their expertise and bring them on. So Professor Tom Conlon, you're very welcome to Business Impact.
Hi, Emmett. How are you?
And it's great to have you a second time around. So, you know, sometimes people don't want to come on a second time around for whatever reason, but you're braving the conversation once again. So it's great to have you. As I said in the introduction, very topical. Everyone wants to hit, get us to the net zero target. Everyone is very much behind the idea of getting carbon emissions down drastically and as quickly as possible. Well, I should say everyone, some people, others see climate change as a hoax and so on and so forth. But most people in mainstream opinion, particularly in Europe, want to see us making far more progress and far faster progress in this area. And I know the people in the aviation area like to say, you know, we're not the worst contributors to carbon emissions, and there is other sectors like agriculture and so on, but they are nevertheless significant contributors to the carbon emissions problem. And there has been all sorts of, I suppose, methods and ways and approaches to get those figures down, get them reduced, new fleet, new fuels, less travel, travel taxes. There's a whole sort of plethora of policy responses designed to get carbon emissions curbed in the aviation sector. So maybe we'd start our conversation a little bit around that area, is just talking to me a little bit about the paper you've done and where aviation fits into this whole carbon emissions debate, Tom.
This week has been earnings week for a lot of companies. And one of the companies that reported this week was Ryanair. And Ryanair have had stellar financial performance. And a lot of this was based on growth that they've been planning for years. They've been bringing on into their fleet lots of new aircraft, linking people around Europe. Thinking more widely in terms of aviation, aviation is one of the toughest nuts to crack in the climate problem. You know, even modest forecasts that we have show that air traffic is going to grow by about 3% per year. And this means that by mid-century, the sector will be about twice its current size. Back to your point a moment ago, right now, aviation accounts for roughly about 2% of global CO2. But the real story there lies in the non-CO2 effects. Things like contrails, the clouds that you see coming out of the back of the aircraft, and other kind of high altitude pollutants. What these do is they trap heat. If we add these in, aviation's total radiative forcing, its ability to stop heat leaving the atmosphere, jumps to about 5 to 6% of the total climate problem. So the challenge here is that, and this is happening, other sectors are decarbonizing reasonably fast. Take energy production and the renewable energy, for example. This is happening. This is really tangible and it exists. If this continues to happen, and we hope that it does, aviation's share of the remaining challenge could rise to about 20% by 2050. So effectively, this isn't a sideshow. Aviation really does contribute to emissions, and this contribution could increase very dramatically in the years to come.
Now, Tom, the last time we checked in with each other on this podcast, there was, I suppose, the conversation was a little bit around the whole area of new fuels. SAF, S-A-F, is one of the particular ones that gets mentioned a lot. There was also talk about weight of aircraft and also just more efficient aircraft types, whether they're coming from Boeing or Airbus. Are you saying in this paper that, yes, those areas are important, but on their own, they won't be enough to get the job done?
Absolutely. These solutions exist. You know, lots of different pathways out there to net zero. Everybody seems to come out with their own different pathway or roadmap towards net zero. And all of these tend to come with trade-offs. These trade-offs that kind of policymakers tend to gloss over. So just to quickly go through the different ways to get to net zero. Fleet renewal. Swapping older aircraft for newer ones. And this saves roughly about 20% in terms of fuel burn. That's real, but it really won't bend the curve towards net zero all that fast. Hydrogen, we hear lots about. Hydrogen aircraft, and it looks very exciting until you start to think about the physics of it. You have a very low energy density with hydrogen. You have very heavy tanks and airports and aircraft that would need a redesign to be able to create hydrogen aircraft. That's not to say it can't be done. It is being done, but it's quite a phase change from where we are right now. Another alternative would be battery-based aircraft. These face an even harder problem, mass. And if you think about it, if you're driving an EV, one of the things we hear a lot about with EVs is the weight of the EV and how this influences the handling. Similar problem with aircraft. The weight of the aircraft won't decline if it's a battery-based aircraft over time. So what I mean by that is if you have an aircraft which is fueled by jet fuel, you use that jet fuel over the flight and the aircraft gets lighter by the end. That doesn't happen with battery aircraft. So these long-haul electric aircraft are effectively science fiction for now. Aviation really requires sustainable aviation fuel. This is the only drop-in option. What I mean by that is it's a solution that we can use right now in the aircraft that currently exist. But with this, the maths just doesn't add up at the moment. The ways that we, or the pathways that allow us to create this SAF or sustainable aviation fuel are, one is used oil feedstocks. So this is the leftover oil from McDonald's. This can supply maybe 10% of future demand. We have biofuels, so using corn, wheat, or maybe leftover parts of bio stocks. These can provide a large proportion, but we run into land use limits. Synthetic fuels, so e-fuels, ones where we'd actually take the carbon out of the air, combine it with hydrogen, may be a solution. It probably is the ultimate solution for aviation and lots of other industries, but it requires massive amounts of renewable power. If we were to take the requirements for Europe, just as an example, to hit the targets for 2050, we would need all of the renewable electricity in Europe right now just dedicated to sustainable aviation fuel. Now, look, in short, the technological tools are available. They're not available at scale, but they are available. But the money, the willingness to take risk isn't there right now. So in order to try and figure out which solutions will work at scale, we need short-term investments for longer-term success. This really isn't happening at the minute.
And Tom, those kind of investments, but obviously some people get a little bit nervous when they hear the words like riskier investments and they say, who's going to bear that risk? Airlines are obviously quoted companies in the main. They've got shareholders. You know, they're not necessarily going to be too minded to put extra money into these technologies. Maybe governments might be also nervous because they have other pressures to deal with. So where might these investments be made by who and in what?
Great question. So look, in our paper, in the paper which is published in Science, and I must give a shout out to my co-authors. We have a very diverse team working on this. David Victor, he's a professor of climate policy in UC San Diego. Andreas Schaefer, who is a professor of aviation technology in UCL. and my good friend Philip Goodking, who is a professor of aviation strategy. So we're looking at this from a lot of different angles. In this paper, we make what I would deem to be a simple but reasonably uncomfortable claim. The bottleneck that we have isn't technology, it's actually finance. Now, to your point, where's the money going to come from? Right now, we have about $1 trillion flowing into aviation by 2032. All of that capital is going to be spent on new aircraft. And this comes from Airbus and Boeing filings. What's that capital looking for? It's chasing efficiency. It's trying to make the business more efficient than it is right now. It's not chasing transformation. So it helps. It will help to reduce emissions, but it isn't going to go far enough towards solving the problem. If we're looking for deep decarbonisation of the aviation sector, we need a new investment logic, one that channels money towards risky and high-impact innovation, not the safe incremental upgrades that we're seeing currently. So as we document in the paper, investors are facing three systemic barriers to making these types of innovative investments. First of all, they can't tell which projects are going to truly move the needle. If they're given a range of different investments that they can make, they can tell the risk and return of these, but they can't tell necessarily how much it's going to help to decouple emissions from growth within the sector. A second issue that they encounter is that they fear greenwashing. Nobody wants to be the next PR casualty of greenwashing. And this is particularly for banks, this is a real challenge. The third issue that investors encounter is they hate risk. They especially hate risks in sectors which have long payback periods and they have uncertain technological bets. And this is particularly true in aviation. So just to take a step back on it, jet fuel itself is a fairly small market. By my estimates, it's about $250 billion per annum. Sounds like a big number, but really isn't. The upside of this is that it's not sufficiently large to compensate for the risks of making the very huge investments that are required. If we were to take a step back and compare this with something like AI and the data center investments that we're seeing in AI, in that case, there's almost unlimited upside potential by achieving what we're hearing called superintelligence. Aviation doesn't have this upside. And lots of other hard-to-abate sectors like cement and steel, for example, don't have this same unlimited upside, which makes it challenging for investors to invest in them.
So is it, and I don't know if you get into this in your paper, but I'm not even sure you want to answer this one, but one of the groups that might bear some of this cost would be passengers themselves, which obviously all of us as consumers will resist on some level, even though some people will see it as playing their part in a wider sort of war against emissions. But is it possible that the ticket price will simply have to reflect at least part of these investments that you're talking about? If other broad shoulders like the shareholders and governments, etc., won't bear it, it will be me and you sitting in the seat, particularly on long haul travel.
Look, somebody, as you say, is going to have to bear the cost. And if we look at for example, sustainable aviation fuels, sustainable aviation fuels are about three times more expensive than traditional jet fuel. The cost for an airline of fuel is about 30% of their overall revenues. So if this goes up three times, the airline won't be able to bear the cost. Airlines are in a sector with cutthroat competition, and small changes in terms of their costs can really influence the business. So what are the tools that are available to us? Of course, we can increase ticket prices to customers. That's one way of going about doing it. Another possibility is that we actually have realistic taxes on aviation and on other sectors like aviation. So at the moment, for example, jet fuel is very marginally taxed. Compared to what you put in your car, it's almost zero tax on jet fuel. We also have carbon taxes. So if carbon taxes were to come into play to the extent that we need them to, this could influence people's decision-making. Now, obviously, this is going to flow through to the bottom line, but this is not something that we think will happen as a shock. So we don't think that it's going to be overnight that the price of flights are going to double or triple. It's a very gradual process. And that gradual process is something that we're very confident, and we've seen, you know, in terms of other decarbonisation approaches, is something that people are comfortable with. You know, if it goes up, if your ticket price goes up by €2 per annum or €3 per annum, you barely notice it. But if that was €100, it's something that becomes meaningful. So while it's inevitable that prices are going to go up, it doesn't have to be a price shock to the sector by any means.
I suppose the complicating factor there is it slightly regressive in the sense that those who can afford to pay the frequent flyers, possible long-haul flyers, will just take it, as you say, and absorb it and get used to it. But those who have lower income will just be forced out. So and that's not your responsibility, obviously, but that is one of the slight challenges, isn't it? That it's sort of, it's not progressive. You know, the ticket will be the same for everybody. It doesn't take account of an income. So there is a slight issue that the rich will keep travelling, but the poor will just be taken out completely and won't be able to travel. Is that unfair on me to frame it that way?
As we know, aviation creates jobs. Aviation creates benefits for the economy. It also creates links that are necessary in a very globalised world. So as we see it, these links have to continue. And one thing that we're very keen on is that aviation is able to continue to grow. We're not looking for a degrowth scenario whereby or we're limiting the ability of people to travel. In fact, if you look at the approach that we propose in the paper, we are also incentivizing growth within the industry.
Yeah, so you're not in the paper, I maybe it teases out, but you're not advocating people cut the number of trips necessarily, or the amount of air travel that's done internationally should be reduced. You're coming at it from a slightly different direction.
Absolutely. No, we're really not advocating that, because the reality is that if the sector is to successfully decarbonize, it needs to grow. It has to have passenger numbers increase in order to be able to create the revenues and ultimately the profits that are going to go to reinvesting in decarbonisation. So if I had to give you a sense of that, what we've proposed in the paper is to make sustainability measurable. We're trying to do it in a way that markets can price. So we propose something called the Aviation Sustainability Index, an ASI. And this is a simple metric that tracks whether aviation is actually decoupling its emissions from growth. So think of it as a sustainability analog to a credit rating. So what's a credit rating? A credit rating assesses the likelihood that a company is going to repay its debt. The ASI, the Aviation Sustainability Index, measures climate performance. And it does that just using two transparent data points. One is the change in traffic. So that's the growth that we talked about a moment ago. We're encouraging growth within the industry. The second thing is the change in emissions. And both of these are relative to some point in the past. So we've proposed the year 2019. So if you take these, you get a single score. There's no hype involved here. There's no unverifiable claims about offsets or future tech. This is just based on data. The other benefit of this ASI is it makes greenwashing nearly impossible, which is exactly why it's valuable. Investors, policymakers, they can see which firms are making real progress and which are just issuing glossy sustainability reports.
Interesting, yeah. I think it'll be interesting. The industry adoption of that will be something fascinating over the next few years. One of the, you've mentioned a lot of different things, Professor Conlon. You've mentioned offsetting there a second ago. We talked a little bit about SAF, the alternative fuels. We've mentioned hydrogen. We've mentioned battery-powered and driven aircraft, etc. So at the end of all of this, are you guys advocating, you and your authors, a particular specific pathway? Or are you saying, no, there's a number of them that will act together, that that's the best way to reach our goal? Or are you saying, no, this one should be preferred above the others? So just give us an idea where your thinking is in that area.
No, it's a great question. We're absolutely not looking for a particular pathway. It's our belief that we certainly don't know which pathway is going to be the best, which is going to scale the best. We would also suggest that others don't know which pathway is going to be best. The only way we're going to know that is by making the investments that are required and learning. So figuring out what works and what's going to scale. And that may be SAF, maybe different forms of SAF. It could potentially be hydrogen aircraft. Maybe there's going to be an innovation in hydrogen aircraft if there's sufficient investment gone into it, which reduces the cost of scaling significantly. But we don't know. And that's one of the challenges that we're facing right now, is that we're working off these kind of roadmaps, which are very prescriptive in terms of what's going to drive the transition. But the reality is that, you know, looking 10, 15 years down the road, we just have no idea which technology is going to be successful and which is going to scale. So we're very much focused on driving the capital into the space to allow this innovation to happen.
Now, obviously, investors will want to see a return. Governments are maybe slightly in a different position. So if you're an investor, whether it's like a bond investor or you're putting share equity into the airlines or whatever, you might be saying to yourself, hey, listen, this is all great getting emissions down and different pathways and all the rest of it. But how do I make a return from my investment in an airline in this environment? Did you sort of look at that part at all, or have you got any reflections on that delicate question?
That's a big part of the focus in this work. The challenge right now is measurability. How do we decide what is the appropriate measure to reward people for success in terms of decarbonisation? Once emissions progress can be measured cleanly, finance is then able to reward it. So this Aviation Sustainability Index becomes a benchmark for sustainability-linked borrowing. So here's how it works. An airline which is seeking capital agrees to hit a target ASI trajectory over time. If it meets or if it exceeds that target, the cost of borrowing drops for the airline. If it misses it, if it doesn't manage to hit the targets, rates stay high. We don't set a timeline on this. We don't set a particular innovation in terms of how you get there. But the earlier the airline hits the target, the sooner they're able to reap the rewards. So you're building in intrinsic incentives into the system.
Are they a little bit like green bonds for airlines? Is that a fair comparison? Or?
That's exactly the idea. This is a green bond or a green loan for airlines. These do exist right now, but there has been very few of them. And the reason there's been very few of them is that the way that the targets are being set right now are very prone to greenwashing.
Now, you're obviously very heavily involved in the aviation courses and modules and programs at UCD. Some people might look in and say, well, is one of the areas we might do more work on as a global population, I suppose, and policymakers should, is to encourage other forms of travel like ferries and boats have been mentioned. Obviously, trains play a part in continental Europe. Do you think these issues will come up in that area, or do you think they are all very separate and kind of march to different dynamics?
No, I think all of this is intertwined. If you think about this from an economic perspective, which mode of transport is the cheapest? That's really what's going to dominate here. If it is the case that using high-speed trains is cheaper than aviation, then there's a pretty good chance that the economics of that will drive people to travel by train rather than by aircraft. The reality right now is that's not the case. You know, the costs of building high-speed rail is extremely expensive, certainly in Europe, and aviation is able to supply the same ability to be able to travel, but at a much cheaper rate.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm constantly having conversations with people about, you know, how you get around, right? How you convey yourself to your destination. And if you know, the ferry thing for us here in Ireland, there is obviously a body of water between us and the UK. So even with the most efficient ferry service, and you may save emissions, but I mean, just from a convenience point of view, you know, trying to get to London via ferry is not very efficient. So, you know, it's just not realistic, that conversation, for time-pressed modern economy of 2025. So I don't know. I mean, I'll let the ferry people make their own arguments, but it does seem a little bit unrealistic, that conversation, at least to my eyes.
Yeah, and I think that's why we're going to see aviation, you know, remain large, and we're going to see it grow, because it is convenient, it's fast, and it's quite appealing to people. People like to fly.
Now, one of the areas you're going to have to do to get both your index adopted, to get even, I suppose, some of the thinking in the paper adopted, is some level of acceptance among the airline industry who are driving a lot of this. I mean, do you imagine you might get people to come on board, no pun intended, what you've devised here? Or have you been talking to any airlines? Any conversations with Michael O'Leary pending?
It's a great question and very valid. Look, this idea isn't stuck in academia. Since the beginning of kind of coming up with this idea, we've been involved with a group called Impact on Sustainable Aviation. This is a non-profit group that brings together airlines, lessors, banks, all trying to come up with credible ways to decarbonize the sector. So to give you an example of some of the outputs that have come from this, we're producing a practitioner's guide. And this practitioner's guide is going to help airlines and banks in using the ASI, the Aviation Sustainability Index, in real lending and investing. We're also in discussions with policy and development finance institutions to try and embed the ASI in what we refer to as blended finance structures, where public capital helps to de-risk the early stages of innovation. And this comes back to your point a moment ago about how does this get funded. Some of this is going to be funded undoubtedly from customers' pockets. But because of the risks involved in this, we're never going to get private investors to fully support this. There's going to be some requirement for public investment. This is happening already to some extent. The EU is putting cash into hydrogen, for example, particularly with, for example, the latest European Hydrogen Bank innovation they've come out with. Something similar is going to happen in aviation. In short, the ASI, the Aviation Sustainability Index, isn't just another academic framework. It's a bridge between climate ambition and financial reality.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much knotty kind of interest here to balance out, I suppose. Obviously, you know, if you're already an airline, you probably have a bit of an advantage because you've got your fleet, you've got your technology, you might be have the newer aircraft. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of consolidation in the airline business, which is great if you're one of the consolidators. But we don't want that to become too consolidated where you have near monopolies on certain routes and from certain markets and so on. So do we have to watch out for that part, that we do still want newer people to come into this industry, new airlines to start up with different new ideas and fresh approaches, that if it's just the current operators, that's not good either. We do need to keep the market dynamic.
Absolutely. You know, every market thrives on competition, and innovation comes from competition. So we absolutely have to keep this an open market. In fact, there's probably still lots of things we can do to make this a more open market. And I think the challenge, we've got a couple of challenges that we have in the EU right now. First of all, in terms of the amount of kind of airspace that we have, you know, we need innovation in terms of air traffic control to open this up and create more opportunities. And we also have a shortage of pilots globally, which is another challenge for the industry.
Yeah, shortage of aircrew, shortage of landing slots, shortage of pretty much everything.
Shortage of aircraft.
Yeah, shortage of aircraft. It's, the only thing we don't have a shortage of is passengers, based on some of the numbers you see going through our airports here and also in the UK and Europe. So it certainly, there had been this idea that after COVID there'd be a short surge and then it might dip, but the traffic patterns seem to be remaining pretty robust. And before I let you go, Professor Colin, one thing I did want to ask you about, it's moving slightly beyond just aviation, but fascinating comments, as I said in the introduction, from Bill Gates, who's very closely publicly associated with the battle against climate change. He seemed to kind of change the orientation of his messaging in the last week or so, where he's saying that, yes, reduction in carbon emissions remains important, but where the money is flowing, there might be better uses for some of the money. And I suppose that fits with your own project. But talk to me a little bit about what your reaction was to his comments.
Yeah, look, what did Bill Gates say? He said that the 1.5 degree target is unrealistic. You know, in my view, he's right. And I think this isn't because ambition is lacking. It's because deployment and experimentation into new ideas are really slow. And actually, aviation helps to prove the point on this. The industry, the aviation industry, loves these neat charts of net zero pathways. But most of these are dressed up kind of efficiency scenarios that would happen anyway. They give this kind of illusion of success. That's, I think, what he's referring to, while avoiding the kind of messy, expensive experimentation that's required for real progress. And this is the heart of the tragedy. We keep waiting across different sectors for miracle scale-ups while underinvesting in the trial and error processes that are going to create these. The fix on this, I think, is very clear. We push capital towards innovation that might fail because that's how breakthroughs happen. And the index that we've proposed helps to direct that flow, not by kind of moral appeal or by vague ESG type metrics, but by giving markets a credible scoreboard for who's actually decarbonizing. So taking aviation as kind of emblematic of what's happening, the carbon problem won't be solved by hope. It won't be solved by PowerPoint trajectories. It'll be solved when the cost of doing nothing becomes higher than the risk of doing something bold.
I'm very disappointed to hear all those PowerPoints about sustainability won't power a plane. Tom, I'm going to have to leave the conversation there. It's been really fascinating. Maybe we'll come back in a few years' time and we'll have a bit more idea where the investments are going and whether what's paying off and what's not paying off. But you've given some very practical tools there that people in the industry can certainly look at and take a greater note of and integrate into. So it's a fascinating project. Thank you for coming on today's Business Impact. That's Professor Tom Colin.
Thank you, Emmett. Really appreciate it.
Now, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the UCD Business Impact Podcast, please subscribe to episodes on Apple Podcast or Spotify. We cover a broad range of topics with insights from business leaders around the world, so there's sure to be something there for everyone. I'd like to thank our production team of Beth Gormley and Mike Liffey. They work tirelessly in the background, sourcing interviewees, editing, promoting episodes, and everything in between. I've been your host, Emmett Oliver, and we hope you can join us next time on UCD Business Impact.